Okay, let's start. I hope you can hear me. Yes, okay. Good. Today's topic is politeness. And I'm not going to talk about opening doors for people and getting up in the bus and things like that, but it's going to be about linguistic politeness, as you've already seen in the reading which I uploaded as an additional reading for today. Before I start talking about politeness and being polite in a linguistic sense, the usual admin stuff, I have two things to say. The one thing refers to the deadline of the second assignment. Please remember, next Monday at 11 o'clock is the deadline for the second assignment. And I've heard from one or two people that they've got major problems with this question about fantastic performance. Okay. What is the speech act performed by the utterance fantastic performance? Now, I'm not going to give you the answer. I already hinted at the fact that it's not as straightforward as you may think. So if you give me the answer, it's a, and then you give me a definite, I don't know, threat, let's say. Well, it's not a threat, okay, but or it's not prototypically a threat, okay, then this is not the answer that I ideally expect. Okay. The only word I'm going to say to help you, and this should be a real giveaway, is context. Okay? That's all I'm going to say, and it should really help. Good. The second thing I would like to mention is the answer to this question. I know a lot of people are concerned about the exam, about failing the exam. I hope this is not going to be an issue at all, but I would still like to tell you very quickly, if you haven't been told yet, you haven't been told the answer to that question, have you? No. Okay. Would you like to know? Yes. Okay. Good. Well, as you know, for most of you who are doing this as a main subject, I mean, who are doing English as a main subject, or the B.Ed. students, you have three exams. It's the TESOL, it's the literature, and it's the linguistics one, and you get a final grade. Okay, you pass the exam if the average is 4.0000 or better. Okay, if you have 4.003 or whatever as average, which is impossible, but I mean just to show that if it's just below 4, then it's a fail. Okay, how do we get there? For each exam, you get 2 marks, one for language and one for content. Content is more important, 60%, language counts as 40%. Okay. So let's say you, in total you get 6 grades which are counted together, weighted differently, and then you get a final grade. Okay. You have to pass language in each exam in order to get you have to pass language. Okay. So, yeah, you have to pass language. Yeah, it's as easy as that. Okay. So, if you, and that's true actually for each exam. Okay, that's why I was saying in each exam. So, if you do a content, give me a content in linguistics, that's worth a 3, but the language just isn't a pass, then you fail the whole of the linguistics exam. Okay, so that's, that's this. Also, the other way around, and we're a bit less strict there, if your content is total crap, I mean, it's just complete nonsense, okay? And we therefore have to give you a fail mark in one of the 3 exams, or 3 parts of the exam for content, but you wrote it in beautiful English, okay? No mistakes whatsoever. It's basically publishable, but it's just got nothing to do with the linguistics bit. Yeah? Then obviously we can't let you pass either. Okay. Well, we're not as mean as that. We say that maximum mark you can get then, maximum grade, is a 4 in this part of the exam for content. Okay. Yeah. I think that's fair as well. Okay. And all of these things are put together, and then there is an average. And this is the thing that counts. So, yes, if you have a 5 in an exam, and you have a 3 and a 4 somewhere else, then you pass. Okay. Theoretically, if you have 2 5s and a 1, you pass. We wouldn't be very happy about this, but we would let you pass. Okay. Does that answer all your questions? There are criteria about language which we, I mean, what we expect. This is something that Professor Stubbs, I think, has on his slides. If not, then he probably distributed this to you already. If he hasn't, I'll make sure that you get this information before the exam. There was a question up there, yes.
Yes, if I have, let's say, a 5, a 2, and a 3.
Yes.
The best mark I can get is a 4, is that right? So if I fail content in one exam, then the average mark is 4?
I'm a linguist, I'm not a mathematician.
I just thought you said something about if you fail the content in one of the exams, best mark, best
ever? No, the best you can...
I'm sorry, the name is wrong.
All right. You have a 5 in linguistics, I hope not, and a 4 in language.
Okay.
You have a 4 in TESOL, and a 3 in language, and you have a 1 in literature, and a 3 in language there. Then all these things are going to be put together, 40% language, 60% content, and we have an average. And if you then get to, I don't know, 3.53, then you'll get a 4. If it's 3.43, you'll get a 3. Yes. Okay. And you can either get a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or a 4 or a 5. Okay, there's nothing in between. All right. Can we do linguistics now, or any more maths? Okay. If there are any remaining questions about how we calculate this, you're welcome to ask me by email. Okay. Also, let me remind you, you are actually allowed to come to my office hours. Yeah? Okay. If you have any questions about anything that relates to the lecture, please do so. Good. I'd like to start with a little bit of revision, and I have a brief extract here, which I think can be used to make a few points that I made last time already. And I'd like to quickly read through this. This is a bit dark, right? Well, let me see whether I can do this without. Is that readable? Yeah? I see a few people nodding. Not quite. I mean, I can try to get it a little bit darker, but then it'll probably... Yeah, exactly. I knew it was that bit. Okay. All right, let's leave it at that then. Okay? Good. This is a conversation in the army. Okay? It's a constructive conversation. It is actually found in a Swedish-English grammar book, which has nothing to do with why I'm giving you this. This is between Andrew, who is the superior of the private office... it's the other way around... Andrew is the private officer is the superior of Andrew. Okay. Andrew salutes. Good morning, private officer says. Haven't you been told the proper way to address an officer? Sorry, no, sir. Not yet, sir. Walks around. Andrew follows awkwardly. There's dust under your bed. Is there, sir? I said so. Yes, you did, sir. Then why ask me again? Again, sir? Didn't you? Didn't I? What, sir? Ask me to repeat what I'd already said. Are you playing me up, airman? Are you taking the mickey out of me? I can charge you, man. I see your game and I can charge you. Yes, you can, sir. Don't tell me what I already know. Oh, I wouldn't, sir. You know what you already know. I know that, sir. I think you are a fool, airman. God knows why the Air Ministry sends us fools. They never select. Select is the answer. Select and pick those out from the others. What others, sir? Now, why is this not really a successful communication or conversation? Mm-hmm. What's going wrong here? How can we put what we see here in connection with the pragmatics lecture that I gave you last time? Okay. Let's have a quick look at the slide again. Do you see anything that fits in with what we have said last time? Anything that you notice in the context of... speech acts, direct speech acts, yes?
Appropriateness.
Appropriateness, okay. In what sense? Sorry?
It's not to the situation. It's not appropriate to the situation and to the surroundings.
Okay, yes, there is something odd about the responses that are given, okay? Let's rephrase it then. What should Andrew have responded instead of haven't, well, no, let's rephrase my question. What does this mean? Haven't you been told the proper way to address an officer? What does it mean? It means, yeah?
Address me the right way.
Address me the right way, yeah. Let me stress, well, it's obvious to you, I guess, but this is in the form of a question. Remember that I mentioned the mismatch between form and function, or form and force, of the Direct Speech Act, or the Indirect Speech Act, rather, sorry. This is a command to the to Andrew to repair what is said. Next week we're going to call it a repair, to do it the proper way. What does Andrew do? He takes it up as a real question. He responds to it as if it had really been an inquiry about the fact whether he'd been told the right way. Now, yeah, that's actually happening throughout the whole conversation. There's dust under your bed. What is that in terms of sentence type? It's a declarative. It describes the fact that there is dust under the bed. Of course, that's not what's intended, we would assume, by the private officer, but what it actually, of course, is a command for Andrew, or to Andrew, to clean up. Okay. And the communication simply fails, because what Andrew does is that he picks up the elocutionary force. The locutionary force. What's going on today? The locutionary force, rather than the illocution. Okay. So he takes this to mean, to be a statement, basically. But it isn't. It's a command. What is this here? I can see your game and I can charge you. What speech act is performed by this? It's a declarative. Okay. But what's actually meant by this? Well, I think quite clearly this is a threat. Mm-hmm. Andrew again doesn't pick up the threat, but just basically confirms that he indeed can charge you. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me what I already know. This is an imperative. Okay. But again, the actual force of the speech act is not correctly understood. Okay. Because of course what's meant here is stop. Okay. Be quiet. So, in all of these exchanges, or in all of these turns, as we will call them next week, there is a problem in the sense that Andrew picks up the Direct Speech Act rather than the Indirect Speech Act. He responds to the locutionary act rather than to the elocution of the utterance. Okay. Now, this kind of thing is also quite often employed in jokes. Here's one which you may find mildly amusing. Let's see. One farmer met another and said, "Hey, Sam, my mule's got distemper. What did you give yours when he had it?" "Turpentine," grunted Sam. A week later, they met again, and the first farmer shouted, "Sam, I gave my mule turpentine, like you said, and it killed him." "Yeah, did mine too," nodded Sam. Okay. Now, what is the standard implicature of turpentine? Okay. I gave it turpentine, it helped it, okay, and it solved the problem. Okay. So, in other words, I think it's fair to say that Sam is not being cooperative here. Sam is not producing a response to the request for help, but he's answering on a much more literal level, telling the truth. Okay, telling what he gave his mule, okay, but not telling that it actually killed the animal. And thereby not responding to the intention of the question, or the implicature, the conversational standard implicature, which we would draw by being questioned, by being asked the question, "What did you give yours? What did you give yours, and what did help that animal?" Okay. So here's someone being not cooperative, and that's why it's mildly funny. Here's another situation which can be put into this context. Do I look fat? Have you thought about working out or joining a health spa? Which maxim of conversation is violated here? Anyone? Is it quantity? Is it quality?
Relevance,
yes. Okay, it's relevant. Okay. And that makes it into an indirect speech act. The only way to interpret something which is not a direct response to "Do I look fat?" is to make it relevant. Okay. Now, I don't think I need to go into detail. What's the connection here? You get this. But that's something that happens all the time. Okay. Well, maybe not this question, but the kind of thing that we are working, that we're using indirect speech acts. Now, I've mentioned the cooperative principle. I looked at this in detail in the last lecture, and that explains how it works, that we are being indirect. Okay. But, and I've briefly hinted at this already in the lecture last week, that doesn't exactly say why people are indirect. Now, this is what I would like to talk about today, and that's where we are in the area of politeness. So last week's lecture and this week's lecture are very closely interrelated. The politeness theory very much builds up on pragmatic theory. It's one part of pragmatics, and that's why I'd give you something on politeness in the second lecture rather than the other way around. Just very briefly, what does the word polite actually mean, or what did it mean before? In 1398, the word is used for the first time. That's according to the Oxford English Dictionary, and then it meant smooth, polished, burnished. Okay. We have the German word Politur, okay, which will be related to this meaning. Okay. And it's really only around the year 1500 that it relates to language, or that can be applied to language here, of language, the arts, or other intellectual pursuits, refined, elegant, scholarly, exhibiting good or restrained taste. Okay. That is quite a semantic change from smooth, but you can see how it belongs together. Right? This is a nice example of semantic change, and maybe you can recall this from the lecture on semantics. Then another 100 years later, in 1601, it can refer to a person, okay, which was not necessarily the case before. Of a person or social group, refined, cultured, cultivated, also well-regulated. Okay. There's still the expression, or the idiomatic expression, polite society, which goes back to this meaning. So now we're coming quite close to what we find today. And then in 1751, we find courteous, behaving in a manner that is respectful or considerate of others, well-mannered. Okay. So, for example, nowadays I can say it is not polite to speak while someone is lecturing, and everyone will get what I mean. Okay. And this doesn't mean polished. Okay. Yes, now it's quiet. Okay, good. Politeness refers to the strategies that we use. No, it hasn't quite worked. It's still going on. Or maybe I hear things down here that you don't hear up there. Okay. It refers to the strategies that we use as part of, well, society, or rather of, as part of the social relationships we have with our communicative partners, or with our, well, with the people that we talk to. Okay. And we can do these things in various ways. We could say, pass the salt. Or we could say, could you pass the salt, please? Now, in both cases, the result is probably going to be the same. Okay. Both impose on the hearer in some way. It's a very small imposition. It's a small thing to ask for. If I'm on the one end of the table and you're on the other, and the salt is in front of you and I'd like to have the salt, then this is not going to be a major thing to ask for. Remember that last time I gave you the example of asking for £1,000 or £10,000, which is a much bigger imposition than asking for, let's say, 50 cents. Okay. But the point that I would like to make is that even asking for 50 cents or even asking for something as simple as passing the salt, it's an imposition in the sense that I am trying you to do something for me. Now the second version does it in a more polite way. It does it in a more polite way because there is the word please, yes. But it doesn't only do it in a more polite way because there is the word please, but there is a second difference. It's a question. So we're using a different form, and by using this different form, we possibly make it easier for the other person to comply with our request. Okay. Now, we could very easily imagine a situation that at a very formal dinner party, we wouldn't ask the person opposite, who may be a very, important politician or whatever, I have no idea, say, pass the salt, but we might, could you pass the salt, please? And at the dinner table at home, we might just say, pass the salt. This doesn't mean that we don't like the person on the other side of the table in any way less, or we appreciate that person less, but in the right context, we may want to use different strategies to get to the same result. Now, there are various ways in which this kind of these aspects of politeness have been analyzed, have been what people have been trying to make sense of how we use linguistic features to communicate different levels of politeness. Okay. Now, the one, and that's also been in the reading, that I'm not going to concentrate much on today is the one that's brought forward, or that was not invented, but was talked about by Geoffrey Leach. And that's, in a way, an extension of the cooperative principle. He thinks that there is something like a politeness principle. And he also postulates a number of maxims that will contribute, or that will enable us to understand how politeness works in the linguistic sense. Okay. There is this example that's given by Jonathan Culpepper from Lancaster, which I think quite nicely illustrates this, and you may have read this already. Let's just quickly read this together. At the annual meeting, general meeting of the university society of which I was a member, I had been witness to the fact that a candidate for the presidency had gained only one vote from the 40 people present in the room. I was asked to summon this candidate from where she had been waiting outside. Upon meeting her, she immediately asked me how many votes she had gained. I clearly remember the machinations of my brain. I could not reveal the truth, since that would upset her. On the other hand, I did not want to seem to be lying. Cornered by her question, I decided to be vague and replied, "Not many." My response thus avoided both a lie and the upset to the hearer that would have accompanied a more cooperative, in Grice's sense, reply. By flouting Grice's maxim of quantity, I hoped that she would draw the implicature that a more cooperative reply would have been more damaging to her, and that I had been uncooperative in order to soften the potential for damage. So it was successful if afterwards she didn't go on and said, "Not many. How many exactly?" Okay, that would have sort of defeated the purpose of the whole thing, but she got the point and didn't ask because she was already aware that would have been information that she wasn't going to like. To say a little bit more, just a very little bit more about this politeness principle, here is a quote from Nietzsche: "Minimize other things being equal the expression of impolite beliefs, while maximizing other things being equal the expression of polite belief." Okay. And there are these various maxims that he mentions. This would be the approbation maxim, minimize dispraise of others, maximize praise of others, etc. If you're very much interested in this, I can give you more reading on this, or I can upload also this to StudIP. I wanted to mention it as background, just to make sure that you're aware of the fact that what I'm going to say next is not the only way to look at politeness. Okay. So there's this maxim-based approach, but the one that's been, I think it's fair to say, much more influential in recent, or over the last two decades, is the face-saving view. That's also discussed in much more detail in the reading which I uploaded. It goes back to Brown and Levinson, 1978. There is a second edition almost 10 years later, and that's still the basis for a lot of politeness work that's going on today. They take up the idea of face discussed in sociology. Goffman's concept of face is at the core here. And they look at how this idea of face, as a sort of social feature of human interaction, has an impact on how we communicate, in other words, how we use linguistic means to take account of this. What is face? Well, I think you all know what face is in the sense of losing face. Okay, if you say something stupid, if you do something that gives away that you are, I don't know, incompetent at something, then you lose face. Or, in other words, your public image suffers. Okay? Suffers some damage, not physical damage as such, but you are worried that the person that you're talking to is perhaps not considering you as, I don't know, educated or likable or whatever than he or she may have done before in your eyes. Okay? So, there might be an element of humiliation or embarrassment or whatever. Okay. Now this is related to what I'm going to say, but Goffman and particularly Brown and Levinson take up this idea of, well, it's a little bit more sophisticated than that, in that there are two types of face, or two faces that each individual in the society has, the negative face and the positive face. What is a negative face? The negative face is the want of every competent adult member, okay, that their actions be unimpeded by others. Okay. Or to rephrase this, I want to do what I want to do and not what someone else wants me to do. Okay. If someone else comes and tells me to do something, even if it is passing the salt, then that is something which isn't compatible with my negative face, or at least it will be a danger, a very slight one, but possibly a danger to the integrity of my negative face. We also have positive face, as I said, and that's the want of every member that their wants be desirable to at least some others. That I am liked as a member of the circle that I am part of. An in-group, for example. Okay. Now, as soon as either the positive face or the negative face is threatened or is in some way in danger of being, threatened is the word, then we're talking about a face-threatening act. Okay. This is usually abbreviated to FTA. Okay. And here is a quick original quote from a short quote from Brown and Levinson. Unless a speaker's want to do, so this is want and as a noun, unless speakers want to do a face-threatening act with maximum efficiency is greater than the speaker's want to preserve the hearer's or speaker's face to any degree, then the speaker will want to minimize the face threat of the face-threatening act. Let's see whether I can sort this out to make it a little bit more understandable. Okay. Either I may just want to do the face threat for whatever reason, not caring about your face threat. Okay. If this is not the case, if I don't think that there is a risk involved, or if I don't care about the risk, if this is not the case, then I will want to minimize the risk. Okay. So, for example, rather than pointing to a person in the lecture now and saying, you are disturbing, you are making noise, you are impolite, I may decide to say, it is not very polite in general, or I may sort of soften the blow and therefore introduce something rather more indirectly. Okay. And why I'm doing this? So that the person who's concerned will not lose face. Okay. It's a strategy to reduce the imposition, in this case, on the negative face. Why on the negative face? Because the person chatting in this room wants to chat, doesn't want to stop. Okay. Now, if I want that person to stop, then it's an imposition. Okay. But still, I may choose certain politeness strategy. People call this face work. Linguistic work in order to take care of another person's negative or positive face. There are several options in going about this. First of all, and this is the direct one, this is the one where I think there is no risk involved, or I don't care about the risk, is just simply to do the FTA, the Face Threatening Act. This is termed the bald on record. Act. Okay, so where I would just sort of point to the person and say, stop talking, okay, or give me a cup of tea, or turn your headlights on, or whatever. Usually, and this is not a surprise, in the form perhaps of an imperative. Okay. How often something like this happens is a different question, but let's just look at the different options now. The second option I'd like to mention is to do the FTA, to decide, yes, it is, I really need that person to stop talking now because it's disturbing me, but I'll use some redressive action. What's redressive action? It's action, it's linguistic action that takes the face wants of the hearer into account. Okay. I'll give you an example. You really should sort of try harder. What does this mean? If you come to my office and we discuss, I don't know, a Hausarbeit or whatever, and it was really not a good piece of work, okay. I could just say, this is crap, you have a 5, bye. Okay. Or I could also be very, very direct and criticize everything, give constructive feedback, but still be very direct. Or I might say, maybe the student is not going to like this so much, and of course I'm criticizing the student here, so maybe I'll be a little bit more careful. I'll use some strategies to reduce the blow. Okay. And we have some kind of hedging of the opinion here. Okay. This is, well, sort of, is some kind of, yeah, some kind of, this is also a hedge. Okay. It's something to say that whatever I say may not be 100% correct, or may not be 100% the way I intend it to be. Okay? So it's different from you should try harder, or you need to try harder. If I say you should sort of try a little bit harder, okay, intonation helps as well. Mm-hmm. But it indicates to you that I may not want to be as direct, and therefore you take this, well, you interpret this as more polite, linguistically polite behavior. This appeals to your positive face want, to be liked, to be part of society. Okay. What is she? Small? Yes, she's small, smallish. Well, not really small, but certainly not very big. So is she small? No, of course not. Okay. But the speaker decides not to say no, she's big, or she's at least average, but first agrees, says small, yeah, smallish. Okay. It's an avoidance of an overt sign of disagreement. Again, this is referring to the face wants, in this case again the positive face wants of the cooperative partner, not cooperative partner, conversational partner, and therefore using a politeness strategy that reduces the threat to the positive face. I'm awfully sorry to bother you, and I wouldn't, but I'm in an awful fix, so I wondered if, by any chance, you could... And whatever. Okay. This is a very elaborate way of starting a request. Okay. Why? Because the person is probably aware that the other person doesn't really want to comply with the request, or feels that it is an imposition that is rather bigger than it should be. Okay. You could do this to someone where there is a lot of social distance, for example. Okay. What is this in terms of politeness strategy? It takes care of the negative face of the other person. The face wants to be left alone, and not to be imposed on by other people, and therefore takes care of negative. This is a negative politeness strategy. So, on record, or on record with regressive action, but you can also do it off record. What's meant by off record? Well, you may remember the point that I made last time, that indirect speech acts can be cancelled. I can say, no, I never wanted to borrow money from you. I just said I lost my wallet, or I forgot my wallet. This is awfully heavy. Okay. What is this is awfully heavy? Well, it could be a request for help. But it's also a statement that is awfully heavy. Are these cookies made with nuts? Okay. Could be a request for information. Could also be, oh yeah, try one. It's fine, yeah? A request for, can I have one? Okay. And you cannot be held responsible for this afterwards, because if the person says, oh no, they're not for now, they're for the party tomorrow. Oh no, I didn't ask for them. No, I just wanted to know. Do you usually use nuts? Because, yeah. Okay. So, this is less of an imposition, because you can even claim that it wasn't an imposition in the first place. And that's why it is off record. Okay. Or, and I'm not going to say more about this, is just don't do the FTA. Okay. You don't want to risk it. You don't want to ask for an extension or whatever, so you don't do it. Okay. Now, there is a famous graph in the book by Brown and Levinson, which I'd like to quickly reproduce here. And it's got this arrow here on the left-hand side. And these are the different options that you have when you want someone else to do something for you, for example. You can decide to do the FTA and then do it on record, and in fact without redressive action. That's the most direct one. Or you can choose to use redressive action and then have a choice between politeness strategies that refer to or take care of the positive or the negative face of the speaker. Okay. Or you can do it off record using an indirect speech act, relying on implicatures, etc., which can be cancelled. Or you can do, you can decide not to do the FTA. Okay. Now, the thing that sometimes confuses people is this bit here. What it says here, it may be a little bit too small for you to read, estimation of the risk of face loss. Mm-hmm. Now, up here, and that may be confusing at first, but start thinking about this and it becomes perfectly clear, it says lesser, and down here it says greater. People sort of think it should be the other way around. Okay. But this is very clear when you think about it. The lesser the risk, or the lower the estimation of risk, the less you fear that there is something happening if you do the FTA, the face-threatening act, the more direct you can be. Okay. If you think, it's not going to matter at all if I am very direct, I do not need to make sure that the other person's face isn't threatened, then you can do it without redressive action. And the greater the risk, the more indirect, the more off-record you might get, or you may in fact decide not to do it at all. So those question marks shouldn't really be there anymore, I think, because it should be clear. Good. The choice between those different things can be almost like put into a mathematical formula. Okay. It consists of several elements. it consists of the, or it, the elements are weightiness of a face-threatening act. So how much of an imposition is it? The difference between 50 cents and 10,000 euros. Okay. Could depend on the social distance between speaker and hearer, D. The power of the hearer over the speaker. Okay. I have a certain limited power over you, okay, in the sense that I need to evaluate your exams. You may therefore use different strategies towards me than if I was someone you were serving in a banking counter or someone like that. Okay, purely because there is a different power differential involved. Okay, or also, and that's the point that I really should have made in the context of the 50p versus 10,000 euros, the absolute ranking of an imposition in a given culture. So if you ask someone to do something in, let's say, England or Germany, this may be a different imposition from doing it in, let's say, Japanese culture or somewhere in South America. Okay. Now, all of this looks like this. Okay? And no, you don't have to learn this by heart. Okay? But you need to be able to tell me a little bit about what might be at issue in the choice of strategies. Now, all these strategies that we employ are actually very frequently employed. Okay? We are hardly ever fully direct. And I'd like to play you a brief extract from last year's lecture to make that point. Okay? I'll call it last year's incident. Oops. Hey, stop. No. Okay, it wasn't supposed to start immediately. Hey, okay, just listen to it. Just listen to it.
This is a statement. This is a statement about the ability of the private officer. Are you having fun up there? No. Would you mind leaving?
Okay, stop. Okay, thank you. What was this? Three drunk students up there. Okay. Who had already at the very beginning started to make funny noises. And, hello, Hoffman. Those kind of things. Okay. And eventually I noticed, and as you noticed, that was at the beginning of the lecture, I used the same example to revise some of the aspects that of the previous lecture. I needed to get rid of them, basically. Okay, I needed to send them out because there was no way. And I was under the impression, standing here, that I was extremely direct. And in fact, in the lecture, I made the point, you see, that was direct. Okay. Later on, I listened to it, and I noticed that I was I was very indirect. What did I do? I asked, are you having fun up there? Okay. This is a very clear, indirect speech act. I didn't say, stop being noisy, leave. Okay. My intention when asking this was actually to, reduce their face loss, I guess, by just indirectly asking them to stop. Okay. They didn't quite get it and said no. Okay. Or they were probably just being honest and said no. Okay, good. And then I said, if you are not having fun, would you mind leaving? Okay. Again, an indirect way of asking. I didn't say leave. And in fact, when I then finally said, leave, I said, please leave. Okay? And thanked them for having left. Okay? And a few students helped as well, etc. So I was under the impression that I was rather direct. Okay? And this is also because, well, the question is, who lost face? Okay? Well, they clearly lost face, I think. Okay, in a way, they were being chased out by others, etc. And they, I don't know, I never met them afterwards. I mean, if you're in the audience, please let me know. But yeah, I had the feeling that it was a fairly strong imposition on their wants, okay, on their face, well, both positive and negative, I guess. And I had to reduce the impact on this, because to be thrown out of a lecture theatre is a rather, well, you don't want that to happen to you. Okay. So, unconsciously, I seem to have applied politeness strategies which I, while doing it, wasn't even aware of. Okay. So I think this is a nice example of the fact that we do this constantly, and that we that it is just part of, well, human interaction, I guess. Okay. Now, beyond FDAs, there is more to politeness theory than just face-threatening acts. Particularly also because Brown and Levinson's work is limited to this idea of a face threat. Okay? And then the work that you need to invest to, well, either reduce the threat or just basically to avoid the threat altogether. Okay? Now, Leach doesn't only talk about doesn't talk about face threats as such, but he also talks about polite acts, in a way, face-enhancing acts, telling someone that they've done a good job, which, by the way, can also be a face threat, interestingly, both to you and, I mean, commending someone else on good work can be a face threat to the recipient, as well as to the person saying it. Okay. But let's not go into detail. So it's not only about face threats as such, but it needs to be extended a bit. Also, what about impoliteness? Okay. There are some acts that simply attack face. Okay. Some conventionalized expressions which simply attack face. Goffman talks about aggressive face work. Okay. Now, this is stuff that's dealt with in recent developments over the past few years, particularly in Lancaster. Jonathan Culpepper is sort of maybe the leading figure in the context of impoliteness. If you're interested, there's a lot more to read there. I just want to make a last point in the context of politeness and beyond face-threatening acts, or evaluating interactions from the point of view of face-saving strategies, namely that context, setting, and those kind of things, of course, are extremely important. That's in the formula that I expressed. But it's also important to think about what is expected. What is the unmarked norm? For example, consider a parliamentary debate. What happens in a parliamentary debate? Okay. Let's say a British parliamentary debate. We've got basically two opposing parties, okay, liberal Democrats as well, but basically we've got the government and we've got the opposition. And what do? Well, they attack each other, right, constantly. They're being constantly nasty to each other. They're saying things like, it seems that the right honourable gentleman has failed to do his homework, for example. Okay. Or, it seems that the right honourable gentleman is not in his right mind today. Now, in other contexts, this would be an extremely serious face threat. In Parliament, this is actually expected behavior, and therefore cannot be evaluated from the point of view of the same action, the same verbal action, in a different situation. So the system in that sense doesn't apply, or rather is all moved up a little bit. Well, not a little bit, quite a lot. Let's have a quick look. I have two short clips to show you what's going on in British Parliament. One, a fairly normal discussion. The second one, a nice compilation of a few assaults, but just a minute each, and that's the break, so you can enjoy this, but just to make get that point across.
The economy. Let's be clear what his legacy will be. Not the most useless government we've had in history, though it is. His legacy will be the biggest budget deficit in Europe and the biggest we've had in our history. So let's be clear about this no plans or no proposals today, as he puts it. A man with no democratic legitimacy, who's never been elected as our Prime Minister, who's been defeated every time the public have been able to vote for him, is now considering trying to fix the rules of the election before the next general election. Isn't that what's happening?
First of all, on public spending and deficits, let him confirm that his proposals are for a 10% cut in the scheme of the next 10 years. If he wishes to raise the question of deficits and debts, let him confirm that that is now the proposal of the Shadow Chancellor to cut public expenditure by 10%, as confirmed by the Shadow House Secretary this morning. And let us have a debate about the choice that really does exist in the country between a Conservative Party that now wants to cut even at a time of recession into our basic public services, and a Labour Party that wants to invest in them. Let him also be honest then with the country that when it comes to calling for election, he has absolutely no plan for dealing with the recession. He has got no policies for dealing with unemployment, no policies for dealing with small businesses, no policies for dealing with the problems of this country. He is an opposition leader who has no plans for government, and he doesn't deserve to be in government.
Okay, it's pretty tough. Okay, direct assault. Okay, notice though that it's done indirectly in one way. He's talking about he. It's not you have no right to be in government. That's because the speaker has to be addressed. You're not supposed in the parliamentary discussion to address your opponent directly. Okay, but still, of course, you could say. From the point of view of face threat, this looks like a very serious attack, but it is not considered as such, it is not felt as such in this context, basically because it's Parliament. Okay, here is the second short clip.
The Prime Minister talks about salesmanship. We all know he's brilliant salesmanship. This is the man that sold gold at the bottom of the market. That's the problem with the Prime Minister. He's got nothing to sell and he's useless at selling it. And while we're at it, I've got a bit more advice for him. This is the Prime Minister who went on American Idol with old makeup on the Barbara Barton. This is the Prime Minister who sits in the pretend bags. He sits in the pretend bags, wondering. Waiting for George Clinton to come for tea. I've got a bit of advice for him. Why does he give up the PR and start being a PM? Yeah.
Okay. I guess this is a bit of a borderline case, okay? And of course it can go overboard. Some of you may know that Joschka Fischer in 1984 said, Herr Präsident, Sie sind ein Arschloch. Mit Verlaub, Herr Präsident, Sie sind ein Arschloch. And that resulted in him being sort of expelled from the current session, and that was clearly that was very serious. And that, so not anything goes, quite clearly, but it's as if the levels are somehow changed. Okay. So that's as much as I wanted to say about politeness theory as such. I'd like to have a quick look at speech acts in the history of English now. And also at politeness and at taboo and the various other things that are changing over time. Okay. Now, speech acts like, for example, apologizing or thanking or something like are difficult to investigate from a historical perspective. Why is that so? Because, when we speak and when we produce speech acts, then that's one thing, but when we read what's written in a book or something like that, we only have written records from the past. It is much more difficult to find out what people would have used in a situation where we use a particular speech act today. Okay. We have certain types of texts that are more speech-like, but even there, it is difficult to evaluate how real they are or how good they are at representing real interaction. So if the correct interpretation of the speech act relies on context, can we apply present-day intuitions to identify the force of an utterance, is the second question. If things have changed so much that the same strategies can no longer be used or were not used at that time, how can we evaluate the seriousness of an imposition, let's say 300 or 400 years ago? Can we assume that the actual speech act is the same across different periods of the language? We cannot assume that the same speech act, that the same utterance forms the same speech act cross-culturally. For example, if I apologize in Japanese, that would be very different from apologizing here. Or something may be interpreted as an apology that is not interpreted as an apology here. So how does this work over a period of 500 years? Yeah, here's the apology of Japanese and American English. Okay. Now, there's the magic word, please. Okay. In this context, I'm reminded of someone, I can't remember who it was now. I mean, you ask a child when they... When they're supposed to say please, they say, what's the magic word? And apparently one of my friends once asked their child, what's the magic word? Abacadabra? Anyway, yes, okay. Now, today we use please in this way, shut the door please. And we can use this to reduce the face threat by imposing on the other person's negative face to reduce, to limit that face threat by sort of softening the blow. Okay. Will you please come here with me? Can I have an extension, please? Grant, could you lean on the book, please? Whatever that means. You just say, please, may I have my Argus card, for example, and then everything is fine. So we use it on its own, like shut the door, please. But also in extension, in combination with expressions like will you or could you, in questions, etc. And it sort of is one of the elements to reduce imposition. Now we have a less typical case, a use that's also still present today. She had felt fortunate in being able to please herself where she lived. Or, so at any rate, then please yourself. Another example, no, he asked you to please stay for supper and we'll go on in the morning. These are slightly different uses, where in fact please here is simply a verb, okay, and that's very different from the kind of shut the door, please. Okay. So let's have a quick look at the development of please, because by doing that we could be checking how the speech act today communicated by using the word please may have changed over time. Or basically we can check whether the assumption that the same speech act is done in the same way a couple of centuries ago is true or not. Okay. If we find please the way it is used today in Shakespeare's work, then that is a suggestion that the speech act has not been changed over the centuries. Okay. Let's have a look at earlier examples. We are at present here without any government, the commonalty not only say, but do what they please. This day they plundered, etc. This is an unusual use for today's speakers. Okay. What they please, well, what pleases them, perhaps, would be what we would say today. But it seems that the syntactic construction in which please could be used 400 years ago, 300 years ago, was different. Another example here. It is laudable to dwell handsomely, but be not too forward to build or set forth another man's house, or so to fill it that it may increase the fuel, if God should please to send fire. What is this? If it should please God to send fire. Mm-hmm. If it may please him. Mm-hmm. So again, quite different. So we can't say that the word, if we only find examples like this, that the word please could be used in the same way as today. 100 years later, I am so please you, a poor cobbler's wife of Preston. Again, this is a different use. Notice that it's now used in sort of some parenthetical comment. You could also say, I am a poor cobbler's wife of Preston, but it's an insertion. I am so please you. a poor cobbler's wife of Preston. I humbly thank you. I have no present necessity of more. But, Mr. Stewart, if you please to draw a note of so much received. Okay. This is getting slightly closer, but still not what we have today. And then only sort of 1839 do we find something which is related to the Speech Act of pleasing, but again, the structure is not the same as what we have today. Here's a letter for the master, if you please, miss. Okay. And it seems that this seemed to have further shortened to the idiomatic please as we have it today. Please, spirit, if you cannot answer by knocks, answer by tips of the table. Now, what I've given you here is basically a short summary of the development, making the point that something 300-400 years ago that we know today was used in a completely different way. I've not given you the whole story, and you'd simply have to believe me that there are no earlier examples of please than 1840 or something like that. Okay. We can look at large amounts of data and come to these kind of conclusions, and I'll be talking about this later in this in the term, actually in 2 weeks' time, when I'll be talking about corpus linguistics. But this basically, the summary is that basically this data suggests that the Speech Act of asking someone for something else, okay, so please help me, okay, or supporting this with the word please, would have had to be differently expressed in earlier periods of the language. Today we can also express those kind of indirect requests with, as I've said already, could, can, would, will you. We can add please to this. Okay. But earlier, this was done differently. You would find things like, I pray you, prithee, by your favor, I beseech you, if it please you. Okay, there's the word please. I entreat you, by your leave. Okay. Here is an example from 1610. This is from a piece of drama. I pray you, neighbors, talk no more. Therefore, I pray you, good neighbors, let us regard, etc. I pray you, Marjorie, and I pray you tell me. What politeness device would we use today? I think we would say, please. Okay, please tell me. Please, neighbors, do this. Okay. But instead, we have a full clause. I pray you. And we have this clause in something that is inserted in the syntax of the sentence. It is something expressed in a very, very different syntactic construction. Some people have called this politeness through parenthetical, whereas please nowadays is a single word that can be attached to a clause. We find it as an insertion, as some kind of parenthetical comment almost, rather than a single word. So quite clearly, the same Speech Act existed earlier on, but it was expressed in a different way. This is the field of historical pragmatics. It's a fairly new area. It's something that's been studied for, let's say, the last 15, 20 years. And one of the difficulties is that it is very problematic to link form and function when you are going back several centuries. Okay, the second last element that I would like to look at today is rude language. Okay, no, you're not going to get four-letter words from me, and you're not going to get nasty language. But I'd like to check at how rude language, or only very little, you're going to get some, but anyway. I would like to see how something like taboo has changed over time. Just briefly, a definition of taboo. As originally used in Polynesia, Melanesia, New Zealand, etc., this is from the OED, set apart for or consecrated to a special use or purpose, restricted to the use of a god, a king, priests, or chiefs, while forbidden to general use, prohibited to a particular class, for example, to women, or to a particular person or persons, inviolable, sacred, forbidden, unlawful, also set of persons under a perpetual or temporary prohibition from certain actions, from food or from contact with others, etc. So this is not necessarily to do with language. It's more with social actions. You're not supposed to go there when you're ill, for example. Or you're not supposed to touch that person because. That's taboo. Now, in linguistics, taboo refers to the total or partial prohibition of the use of certain words, expression, topics, etc., in interaction, in social intercourse. Now, there are some almost universal taboos that exist in all cultures that have to do with such aspects as madness, sex, excretion, disease, and strangers, etc. They just sort of repeat themselves. An example of this can be seen in Sterben, the old English word for, well, you will probably recognize Sterben. Right? This actually is, I'll call it a euphemism, okay? To become stiff. To go forth, okay, is also a euphemism. To depart, okay? All of these are euphemisms for death, okay? Because death is a taboo. Now, swearing in Old English, 1,500 years ago, we know very little about that. Okay? We know very little about this because very little has survived. We have only a few million words of Old English to look at. Okay? And much of it is poetry, okay? Or a lot of, well, quite a proportion. And of course we would expect what some people have called dignified restraint of the language in poetry. But there's another point to be made. It's not really swearing at what we have today, quite a lot, but we are talking about swearing by, okay, by certain deities or whatever. In fact, this was something quite serious back then. Apparently, there were laws passed, do not ever swear by the heathen gods. Okay? You swear by a particular god. Notice also the second commandment, of course. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. So swearing by a particular deity would have been considered a taboo, much more so than what we have today in terms of swearing at something. It's not the case that the language as such wasn't rude. You find quite a lot of rude language, at least by today's standards. Here's a brief extract from Chaucer, Middle Ages, okay, Middle English. I'll give you the modern English version. Thus screwed was this carpenter's wife, in spite of all his guarding and his jealousy, and Absalom had kissed her lower eye, and Nicholas is scalded in the arse. Okay. So this is not the same as swearing by a certain deity, and therefore this results in blasphemy. This is a different type of rude language. And in fact, that was also considered rather bad. There was actually in the Renaissance much concern about the use of rude language. There was a master of revels which was in a way political censorship, but it also had something to do with the theatre and the importance the impact on society. There were acts passed on swearing. You're not supposed to do this. And the result of this was some kind of minced oaths, very often, shortened oaths that could not be recognized. So, for example, zounds or gad instead of, referring to God. Okay. And in fact, it even led to, at some stage, I mean, the importance of censorship led to the abolition of stage play completely for various reasons. Now, there is still rude language, but it's more subtle. Okay? Actually, yes and no. Shakespeare's plays actually contain a lot of insults. I'll give you one here. Well, not one, a collection. A knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base prout, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, action-taking, horse on glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogue, etc., etc. This is from King Lear. But this is clearly rude language. But much more so than that, we also find a lot of wordplay and innuendo. Let's see whether you get this. Anyone read Hamlet? This is Hamlet and Ophelia before the play within the play scene. Lady, shall I lie in your lap? No, my lord. I mean, my head upon your lap. Eh, my lord. Do you think I meant country matters? Yeah, we'll come back to that word later. I think nothing, my lord. That's a fair thought to lie between maiden's legs. Full of innuendo, full of wordplay, that would have been perfectly noticeable to the audience at that time, but like a indirect speech act, it can be cancelled, or in that sense it can be, well, Shakespeare could have said, I never meant that. Okay. A very common way even today, of course, of evading political censorship, to say it in a way that you cannot put your finger on it and say, this is actually saying something against the government. Still, Shakespeare was too much for some later on in the history. There was something known as the family Shakespeare, which took care of all those issues of innuendo. Nothing is added to the original text, but those words and expressions are omitted which cannot with propriety be read aloud in a family. Okay. So, out damned spot became out crimson spot, because damned was blasphemy. Or God, the expression, became heavens. Okay. Then, of course, there was a time when the language grew a lot in terms of vocabulary by using a lot of Latinate words. Okay. There was a lot of enriching of the language for various reasons. But it also produced a good source to obscure certain meanings. Okay. The decent obscurity of a learned language. Okay. So we have concepts like perspiration, urination, micturation, defecation, copulation, rape, consummation, erection, orgasm, intercourse, etc. Now all of these are sort of hiding behind their Latin roots, so to speak. It's much more indirect in a way than the strong and direct emotive Anglo-Saxon terms. Now in the 18th century that then went on to a sort of, well, what's commonly known as the period of decorum, where taboo words were pretty much excluded from dictionaries. And still today, some of your dictionaries may not include words that are considered taboo. Okay. I recently bought a speech recognition software. Mm-hmm. And I tried to train it, and I tried to, You have to do those kind of things. It's actually quite good, but it got a few words consistently wrong. And at some stage, I sort of jokingly swore at that piece, well, the software, and used a four-letter word, mm-hmm. which it didn't recognize. So it doesn't know nasty words. Okay, I didn't train that. Okay. So in that sense, there is still this element of rude language which is considered not appropriate even today. Okay. Place censorship continued. Beginning of last century, we had Shaw's Pygmalion. Eliza Doolittle exclaimed on stage, "Not bloody likely," which caused a major uproar because bloody was a really, really bad word. So it's not even that long ago. Okay. And then we had Lady Chatterley's Lover, which really was only unbanned in 1960. What was it banned for? Well, for example, for things like this, here conveniently coloured. Okay. This goes back to the country matters, by the way, if you didn't see the allusion before. It's an old word. Good. Theoretical censorship was abolished in 1968, and now we have the situation as it is found today. But what's really rude language today? Nowadays we no longer have a situation where we're swearing by, or we're swearing on something, or swearing by a deity, but we're much more swearing at. Okay. So we could say that the history of rude language, or of insult, of being impolite, is from being sort of from having religious aspects to, well, moving over to the lower physical faculties of copulation, defecation, and urination. Okay. Right, that was a brief overview of rude language. And now I'd like to end a few minutes early again, as is almost usual nowadays. Okay. End on a few notes on politeness across cultures. Because what Brown and Levinson said is that their mechanism or their idea of face-threatening act and the linguistic strategies used to reduce the impact is actually something that can be applied universally. But as we all know, or anyone who went to a different culture knows that politeness strategies are culture dependent. Okay. So an example here, acts of complimenting and thanking are much more common in British culture, okay, or Anglo culture, where you constantly thank the other person, much more so than in China or Africa, if you want to make a very common generalization. If you want to say no to a request in Japan or China, then you are much more likely to use an off-record refusal than directly saying, no, sorry, I can't do this. I'm afraid I have a lecture to go to or something like that. Now, the point that that Brown and Levinson make is, yes, of course there are differences, but the whole system as such still applies. And in the same way as the parliamentary discussion, in a way, has to be looked at from a different perspective within the same system. Different cultures may require alternations to the kind of strategies employed for the same imposition as such, but they are evaluated differently in different cultures. I can give you one example of a cross-cultural communication exchange that I had some trouble with. A couple of years back, got an email from someone who had invited me to do a lecture in Japan. I was very happy, he invited me. It was two lectures, I went to Tokyo and Osaka, I could look at the country, and he paid for the airfare and paid for food. I was a happy bunny. Okay. And then I got this email a while after I had returned. Can I ask you a very strange question, which I should not ask you now? When you came to Japan to give a demonstration of your BNC web, did I pay you enough money, including travel costs and your lecture? I cannot remember how much I paid you, and I'm very scared to know whether I paid you the amount I told you before you came here. You gave two main lectures here and in my university with people from outside, and the other at Osaka University organized by Mr. Tabata. Though it is an awkward question to ask and answer, I'm afraid if I did what I said to you, please feel free to answer. What on earth does that mean? Okay. Now, I knew about the difference between politeness or between strategies used for... I knew that there was something different in Japanese culture, okay? But I don't know Japanese culture very well, and I was trying to read something into this, okay? In the end, I asked a few people, and also from the next few exchanges that we then had, it actually turned out that he was seriously concerned about having underpaid me, which was definitely not the case. But I was actually afraid that this was a very veiled way of asking for money back. You know? I don't know whether you feel the same, but I mean, I didn't quite know. Mm-hmm. Or let's look at this. This is two businessmen meeting for the first time. This is Mr. Richardson, who is an American. Okay. And then this is Mr. Chu, who is Chinese. By the way, I'm Andrew Richardson. My friends call me Andy. This is my business card. I'm David Chu. Pleased to meet you, Mr. Richardson. This is my card. No, call me Andy. I think we'll be doing a lot of business together. Yes, I hope so. And then Mr. Richardson is reading Mr. Chu's card. Chu, Hon Fai, I'll give you a call tomorrow as soon as I get settled at my hotel. Okay. And then Mr. Chu is smiling. Yes, I'll expect your call. Okay. You can see that something is not working out here. And it's got to do with different cultural expectations, when to call someone by their first name. Also, this is a Chinese name, Chu Hon Fai. Now, notice that, of course, David Chu has chosen for himself or has traditionally been given both a Western and a Chinese first name, and he uses the Western name in connection with business with Western people, with American people. Okay. And the fact that in Chinese families, first names are really only used within the family, at least that's what I've been told. Mr. Richardson does not know this, and in a way he's assuming something, some kind of familiarity that he doesn't have. Okay. At the same time, Mr. Chu is very much not taken aback, but uncomfortable with calling Andrew Andy, okay, Andrew Richardson. And he sticks to Mr. Richardson, therefore being, in a way, impolite towards the American business partner. So a lot of things are going wrong here, purely on the basis of linguistic features, okay, or of language being used. Okay. The final example is this one. This is something that is produced in a meeting just before Hong Kong became part of China again. Okay. And this is a recommendation that's issued. And can you please tell me whether this is something that an Asian or an American has said? Because most of our production is done in China now, and it's not really certain how the government will react in the run-up to 1997, and since I think a certain amount of caution in committing to TV advertisement is necessary because of the expense, so I suggest that we delay making our decision until after LECCO makes its decision. LECCO was a body that was involved in the transition to the Chinese government. Is this Asian? Is this an Asian or is this an American? Yes.
American.
Why?
Because
it's pretty
direct.
Yeah, but that's, you're actually wrong. It might be, but is he really pretty direct?
Well, I suggest that it's more direct than I think.
Okay.
Asian.
Okay, but notice, I mean, we are here in a business meeting or in a meeting where this person is actually now supposed to offer recommendations. Yeah, so, yeah, you didn't know this, etc. But notice that the important point comes at the end. The suggestion comes at the end. And he sort of babbles on, put in a very negative way, at the beginning. Now, this is because different cultures seem to have different ways of structuring pieces of information and giving recommendations. Now, I'm making a very general point here, and I don't know much about Chinese culture in order to say whether this is generally true, but let's just have a quick look at what could have been the American's version, if there had been such an American in that meeting. I suggest that we delay making our decisions until after LECCO makes its decision. That's because I think a certain amount of caution in committing to TV advertisement is necessary because, and etc., etc. This is more direct, isn't it? Because he makes the point first and then explains, while the Asian explains first and then makes the point, by which time the Americans may have switched off. Yeah? So differences in strategies in creating a text, thinking back to our text linguistic text linguistics lecture, can also lead to cultural miscommunication. And this kind of thing can be extremely important in, for example, job interviews. If someone is asked a direct question and then goes on sort of evading the topic for the interviewers who may be from a different culture, and then only makes the important point at the end, then this will have a very different impact on the evaluation of that candidate as someone useful for the job than if he had said it the Western way, let's in inverted commas. So these are very real. This is sort of a very real impact on much more than just language, but language basically has an impact on social realities, on getting a job, and all those kind of things. Good. So I'm only 3 minutes early today. And I'll leave you with that.